And we're back, and you are listening to Villaincast, BJJ Antiheroes, with myself, Chris, the Villain Pains. Weekly podcasts featuring either my fellow black belt Naki Arshad on our show Reap the Week, or compelling interviews with other personalities across Jiu-Jitsu. But first, a quick thank you to our members at In Theory BJJ, concept-driven Jiu-Jitsu, for fight commentary, technique and concept videos, private coaching, monthly webinars and Q&A sessions. Please visit www.patreon.com/intheorybjj. So this is going to be a weird one. This is live. It's not through the app. It's not done online. I'm actually sitting in the gym with Charles Harriott and Steve Hordinsky. This is a three-way podcast. If you're watching this on YouTube, it's going to be very confusing just due to the microphone setup. I have to sit behind the camera. But I am here. We are in Denver, Colorado. Littleton?
Yes.
Yeah, what the hell are we doing in Littleton? How you going? How's it going? We are just fresh off finishing a seminar here. You
going
guys can
great.
Speak.
Oh, yeah. I was like, you had such a powerful interview. I'm like, it seems like he knows what he's doing here with this. Yeah, we're here because, I guess, of you meeting Derek some years ago, and then our friendship being found, forged with Steve, and then coming back for your triumphant return 2 years later. Yeah,
it has been 2 years. And no, you've both been on the podcast separately. I think it's hard to remember now. I think we're up to about 60 episodes, and I can't remember what the hell I've done. But no, we had Steve on prior, and it was a really interesting conversation we had, like your history of jiu-jitsu. So it's really interesting as well. Like, so we've just been sitting on the mats for the past 30 minutes just talking jiu-jitsu, and I'm like, for fuck's sake, if you guys would just stop, I could then record all this, because like now we're here and everything's recording, there's nothing to say.
We'll find things to say.
Like,
the three of us are all exceptionally long-winded when we want to be. There will be things to say.
So, super brief then, just in case no one has heard the other two episodes that you guys have been on, like, I highly recommend going back and listening to those. We'll start with Steve. You have been training for, what, almost 30 years now?
Yeah, 1997.
Dude, that's so jiu-jitsu. Messed up.
Yeah.
I feel weird sometimes that there's people in the gym and I'm like, wait, I've been doing jiu-jitsu longer than you've been alive, and you can drive, like, or at least like you finished school, and like you're, I can't even
getting
like,
old.
That's, yeah, exactly. yeah, we're all getting old.
I didn't realize I was that old until you just reminded me.
Yeah, so and that's as well, like, you know, Denver is where our MMA began essentially. And you're ground zero for everything. Like, so brief, yeah. So you started training in 97. Like, yeah. Who did you first start training with?
So I was in the Navy. I was stationed in Hawaii. I started regular martial arts, you know, Kempo karate, and, you know, did some, you know, boxing and stuff like that, the striking arts. Wrestling was something that appealed to me after watching Hoist in the first UFC, you know. And, you know, from there, I went into the military, continued my training, and I just happened to be stationed in Hawaii. I was on deployment, and we had Marines on board, and one of the Marines, Phil Cardella, he was training jiu-jitsu at one of the satellite schools, and they were two brothers that were running it, Chris and Mike Onizuka, and Phil Cardella was one of their guys. And so he started teaching me jiu-jitsu when we were on deployment. He was a Marine, and then from there, just, you know, got really hooked on it. It worked. It was effective. I enjoyed it. And it stimulated that part of my brain where it's like, you know, I need a problem. Give me a good problem. And jiu-jitsu always gives you a good problem to solve, right? It's never ending. So I just kept going, and I started training with Helsin. And then I trained with Helsin all the way to from white belt to second degree black belt. And then, you know, start working with Master Kaiki. And then third and fourth came from him. So, yeah, I started in Hawaii. It was fun. Barrett Yoshida, he was one of my main training partners, so getting smoked by him pretty much every day, that was major tough. And then we had some big boys, you know, Hawaii, and being like a kind of a you know, being a Holly military guy, you kind of get, you know, you got to earn your place there, you know. So you get tested a lot, and then, you know, I stuck around and made a lot of friends. So, yeah, started in Hawaii.
It'd be fun to get Barrett on one day, because he's pretty sure we've spoken on Instagram before, but
yeah, just
I'll have to drop him a message.
I've been trying to get him out here to do a seminar. He's busy.
Yeah, he's also, like, one of the, like, more progressive legends. Like, he's kept up. He still competes with the 20-year-olds despite his age. And, like, and he hangs. Like, you can tell, like, he's wanting to continue growing. He's not frozen in time with his jiu-jitsu like some of his contemporaries have been. But, like, it's always been very impressive watching him, even, like, EBI stage and other things.
He's always been, like, like, I'm glad that he was my training partner. I'm glad that I locked in with him for the time he was at Helsin's, because he showed me how to do jiu-jitsu or approach jiu-jitsu, drilling. Yeah. You know, he found movements that worked really well, and he said, we're going to do these drills, and we would do those drills. And then he would say, where's your jiu-jitsu log? He was always telling me, what's your game plan? You know, like, and, you know, he might not remember all that, or maybe he does, but, like, it was very impactful. And it gave me a way to approach jiu-jitsu, which allowed me to always be open to new ideas. And, like, that's how, you know, I'm old school, but I'm not, because that's my lineage, but I'm not old school because, like, I get to work with you guys, and you guys bring in the modern and the unorthodox. And I always felt, like, innovative on the mat because of the way I watched Barrett, you know, show me how to start to be a blue belt, how to be a competitor, you know. And watching him do some impressive stuff in competition. And, you know, we were together for, you know, a few years on that mat. And then he went to Grappling Unlimited. And then from there, he was just ADCC. He was battling out with Hoyler. I was like, he's going to get him. Never got him, but he gave him good runs. And then, you know, it was beautiful to watch him do that back then. And then you see him get inducted to the ADCC Hall of Fame. You can see him. He's still out there doing it. Like, that dude's an OG, man. Yeah. He loves competition, man. He's another animal. He's an animal.
Yeah. I think I remember seeing him at the ADCC 2011 in Nottingham.
Yeah. Like,
back when it was in England. For the one time. And what a weird city to put it in. Why crazy. Nottingham? That's like that was the last ADC, I'd say, of, like, the legends.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm pretty sure that was the last one where you had, like, Marcelo, you had Rafa Mendez, Henzo was there, Mario Sperry, Jacare, Braulio. But it was, that was that was the swan song of so many people that, you know, by the time the next one rolled around, it was, you know, Tonin was appearing and JT Torres.
Yeah,
it was,
like, the new guard.
Yeah.
So I was so happy, like, you know, Barrett Rashidi was there. I was just like, wow. Like, I you know, 23-year-old me just couldn't comprehend how big that event actually was.
Yeah.
Which is surreal. So then moving on to Charles, we're just how far are we through? 2/3 through this now. This seminar tour. And yeah, so if anyone hasn't caught up with Charles Harriet yet, if you haven't paid any attention to BJJ Globetrotters or anything I've been talking about or any of the seminar postings that I've been putting up, please, sir. Remind them.
I'm Charles Hart. It's funny that we have a similar background. I started martial arts when I was really little because I wanted to be a ninja turtle and or just a ninja in general, anything like that. Did Taekwondo, American Kenpo. Yeah. And then, oddly enough, my American Kenpo school had they called it ground fighting program. And at like 16, 17 years old, I was the best ground fighter at the Kenpo school. But that's kind of like in the land of the blind. Like I had one eye with cataracts on it, but I could see better than everybody else. And like my entire move was just a headlock. And I was dominating with just like a wrestler's headlock that I would just squeeze and walk in circles. And we were not sophisticated enough to escape that. So that was a finishing move, like a simple wrestling headlock while doing the Homer Simpson. That was my... I would literally watch UFC and be like, why don't these guys headlock more? They're missing out on the gym. I don't see why all this guard, arm bar, this is too complicated. Just headlock.
Weirdly, because I came in traditional Japanese jiu-jitsu. I remember like reading about, because the family that taught me, the Tunstall family, And I saw that the Gracie family had their own jiu-jitsu school. And I thought, oh, it's just another family that runs a jiu-jitsu school.
Yeah.
and then I started to come across BJJ, and I just thought that stuff a blowjob job. And I was like, what the hell is this Gracie blowjob job going on?
It's so funny you say that. I had this T-shirt that I got. It was a brown T-shirt in like the UPS logo.
Yeah.
And it said, what can BJJ do for you? And back when I had a day job, I went to my company wearing my brown, what can BJJ do for you? And I walked past HR and they're like, Charles, I don't think this is appropriate. What can BJs do for you? And I'm like, no, it's BJJ. It's different. It's like, okay, whatever you say with BJJ, not okay at work. And I'm like.
Yeah. Exactly. It took a long time for me to understand it didn't mean blowjob job. I was very disappointed.
Even now, I still cringe when I see but, that. So because like back in the day, it was like that. I didn't want to wear the BJJ Inside BJJ podcast.
Oh,
they gave me a T-shirt. Look, I didn't want to wear it because it was a cool podcast, but I didn't wear it because it's like BJJ and nobody really.
Yeah.
It's
still difficult. It's only, I guess, coming slightly mainstream now, like BJJ.
I'm just going jiu-jitsu.
Jiu-jitsu is easier to say. People are like, oh, it's a Japanese thing. Then they go hi-ya and think it's karate. Yeah, I'll take that
over the others.
But then from there, I went to college, and there was an MMA gym. And I walked in there and met some of those guys and realized very quickly that, like, oh, I know nothing about actual grappling. And I went back home to my friends, and I was like, hey, guys, guess what? You all suck. Hey, don't be mean. You want to know how you know you suck? Because I beat you, and I suck. So by the transitive property, you must suck too. Fast forward to getting into judo, kickboxing, Muay Thai, and then I think the time that really got me into just jiu-jitsu was when I got deep into leg locks, and I had the realization that, like, I don't have enough time to be good at everything. Like, jiu-jitsu on its own, regular conventional jiu-jitsu, was already a lot when combined with practicing judo. I was doing kickboxing at the time and choi li foot kung fu and some Muay Thai. Like, I was doing all of these things at the same time, and then, like, I want to be great at leg locks. I don't want to just grip it and rip it, like, was kind of the fashionable thing at the time. And I was like, I just don't have enough time. And so slowly they died off. Kung fu died off. Judo died off a bit until it was like, I guess I'm just doing jiu-jitsu.
Yeah.
So, and fast forward to leaving my job in 2017 and then started traveling in 2018, slowly got this cool situation where people are willing to pay me to teach them jiu-jitsu. And I haven't gone completely broke yet, so bills are still getting paid, so I get to keep traveling and teaching people jiu-jitsu. So,
I think that's one of the things about this little triangle we've got going on right here, this menage a trois.
keeping the line going, blowjob job, menage a trois. Let's do it.
is especially like when we were talking earlier about how we teach white belts. Steve and I are running our own academies and having these having to build programs from the ground up. And you know, you're mostly on the seminar scene. Like, how it's interesting, like how you then progress your jiu-jitsu and how you then come across your teaching ideas compared to us, where we have to just bash these things into people's heads on a daily basis. I think, you know, it's an interesting, I've always tried to climb into your head to figure out how you're approaching jiu-jitsu compared to what we have to do, and have to unravel so much stuff. And if we adopt something new, if we want to try and be progressive, we have to look at our white belts and go, shit, sorry, kind of taught you wrong for a bit there. I'm gonna have to show you something else.
Yeah, I think that I've made some shifts. In the very beginning, I knew that, especially when I was first traveling, I wasn't certain I was ever gonna see these people again.
Yeah.
Right? Because when I first started traveling, I didn't believe I was gonna keep traveling. I was like, I looked at my savings and money that I had left from my day job. And I was like, I can probably live for about a year because I live really cheap. I can live for a year on this and then I'll probably go back to the regular world. And so I was like, teaching a seminar in Vietnam, the chance is I might never see these people again. So I'm not gonna start them off. All right, here's 2 hours of Spider Guard that you will promptly forget as soon as I leave. And so my whole goal was like, I need to leave as much of an impact as I possibly can in the amount of time that I'm there. And that's part of what led me to kind of searching out what am I good at that other people aren't and what'll stick. And actually it's very similar to the nature of how you like to teach seminars now, because of the fact that like, I'm not gonna get you amazing in a move in an hour, but I can ideally leave a nugget in your brain of like, huh. If I can make you go, huh, and make you stick with that one piece. And so I realized, let's try and speak of things as simply as possible. Let's try and get things into compelling sentences. So I got obsessed with the notion of compelling sentences, which is part of why when I first met both you and Preet and listened to you teach, Preet had a couple of compelling sentences. I'm like, fuck, that's the sentence I've been looking for for 2-3 years. And he just said it better than I did. And so I can be angry about it, or I can just rob him with accreditation. Because I used to say the checklist, right? Every school, and I thought I was clever about it. Every school says head, shoulders, hips. I was like, head, shoulders, hips, backs of knees. And I was like, I got the fourth one. Everyone else is stuck on three. I felt better. But when he described it as a continuous space, I was like, fuck, that's good. Because then I don't have to be at your hip, because it's still useful to be at the side of your quad or in your ribs. And so I always did that. And then when I was teaching technique, like leg locks 101 was the very first like thing I obsessed over, because I realized a problem in jiu-jitsu. Everywhere I went, we had our jiu-jitsu stupidity at the time, which was leg locks are both useless and dangerous. And I was like, how? How can they be both dangerous and not work? And so I made a whole course on making things safe, and I did that a bunch of times, and I was like, really slice things up small, but I'm teaching a lot. And what I learned back in 2021 when I did kind of what you guys do, because I got a substitute teaching job in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I was running a gym for a month.
Yeah.
But I was still, at that point in time, in the mentality of teaching a dense hour. And what I realized is people cannot handle a dense hour of seminar-style jiu-jitsu every day for a month.
No.
It's just too much. It's too rich. It's like you're going to eat that overly sweet, decadent dessert on your birthday. But if you eat that every day, you're going to get diabetes. And so like I had to shift back to teaching less, which I think is more of what you guys are doing. And I had a situation back then where I was asking a bunch of my friends, what is the first thing you teach to your students? And realizing that there was absolutely no standard in jiu-jitsu as to what fundamentals or basics were. And so that's kind of what led me there, is like I wanted to make sure that I was memorable and that I had an impact. I didn't want to just do what I had experienced in seminars, which was, wow. So when someone teaches you 87 things, that guy's so good. Like, I'll never be able to do that. Like, he's a world champion, he's amazing, he's so gifted and talented, or she's so gifted and talented. And you leave, right? Like, there's a whole YouTube channel called, like, Less Impressed, More Informed, or whatever it's called, Less Impressed, More Involved. But, like, I felt like seminars were about convincing people that you were good at jiu-jitsu rather than helping them get better at jiu-jitsu. Yeah. And I kind of set my seminars up to be the antithesis of that. And just slowly going through, broad theoretical approaches to choke theory, joint lock theory, sweep theory. And I can make a difference in your jiu-jitsu in 1 hour with that.
Yep.
Whereas I won't be able to have you play Sumi Gaeshi like me in an hour.
Well, that's then the question, Steve, is like, you know, you've been around this game for shy of 3 decades, and you were there, like, you know, in the original kind of Gracie style. Mm-hmm. So that's what makes it quite interesting. That, you know, we talk about people who are very, you know, not to shit on him in any way, because he's a fucking legend. But the weekend with Lovato, like, you know, talking about that kind of the old school being fed to the new school. Yet you know, someone who's come from the old school, you've adapted. Yeah. And, like, you know, it would have been very easy to stick to the 101s with regards to teaching students. But, like, I say, the fact that you've had us in here multiple times now and along with many other people, like, how do you find unpacking all that seminar content and then adjusting, like, when you run an academy this way?
So I'm when I was... I learned the the ideas of like that jujitsu, like street effectiveness, you know, all the principles like leverage.
Yeah.
Leverage over strength, time over speed, natural body movements, all these things. And then I still try to play those in my head, but a lot of it was like once I got the basic idea, it was a lot of self-discovery. So I've always had more of a curiosity for movement and efficiency rather than sticking to a standard. I'll break the rules, you know, because I think you have to understand how deep you can go into a technique, you know, how effective it can be. And then what I started seeing is like, it's not the technique, it's the concepts. The concepts are what really, really allow you to evolve. And what I do with my students, like if I find something like, and I did this with both of you guys, like the ideas you gave me were simple enough, but there were ideas where I was like, I can use that in a lot of places. I need to explore this and study this. I need to explore this. I need to study this. And then I just get in and I train and I expose it. I try to expose it to a lot of different bodies, different styles, MMA fighters, hobbyists, competitors, no-gi competitors, and just see like, how is this holding up? And then from there, you know, because of like, I don't put restrictions on what I'm going to learn. Like, I like it all. You know, like if it's something like, I'm telling you, if you could show me a move where all I have to do is look at you away and you tap out, I'm fucking doing it all the time, bro. You
know, like, waiting for that dim mock.
You're like, I mean, like, here we go. What is he doing? I'm tapping. You know, like, whatever, man. You know, but like, and then I, you know, what's interesting is like, I start finding these ideas, especially like the inside, you know, and understand the pillars like you showed, and then the frames and the you know, the orphan limb, keeping the leg inside. It changed a lot, man. And, you know, that felt better on my body because structurally, my body wasn't taking a beating now. And I also go for feel, like the, how does that feel to my body? And that's one of the things that I drilled a lot in the beginning is that I would drill for a feeling, not for a submission. I would drill to, how did that feel? That felt effortlessly. All right, we're on the right track. And then I use the move, you know, like, all right, it's effortlessly. But that was at the surface level, and it's like teaching. How do you make people understand this? You can't, like, they're not going to learn like you. You're not going to look like we learn. I feel like we probably learn differently. To be at a higher level of understanding of jiu-jitsu and being able to apply it, I feel like not everybody's going to be like that. How do you build someone like that? Some people are gifted. They can learn. They learn. They're good learners. And then, like you put them in these positions, and you tell them, all right, keep your balance here. Like, don't, here's the game. Don't get swept. Keep your balance. How do you keep your balance? You know, show them how to put the like you did today, the postures, you know, the postures that are going to allow you to be strong there, you know. And that right there was the best way to start teaching, I found, is that, all right, here's the game, you know. I want you to be strong in this position. Hold this. Don't let them fuck with you. Don't let them fuck that up. And if they do, reset, go back, adjust. Don't let them do it again.
I think to piggyback off that, like, it was giving, because you notice, like, ever watched me teach, like, I go heavy into analogy. I'm almost always making either a food analogy or some other strange analogy. The food analogies come more when I'm hungry. That's why I have a lot. Like, if you think of, like, I have taco grip, I have burrito grip, I think you called it a cone grip from
ice cream cone.
From the ice cream cone, yeah.
Well, what does that say about my mentality then, considering the general fucking jokes that I come out with and analogies of, well, today was G-spot and suck your own dick and
like, you know, it's all about where your mind happens to be that day or in life. So it just means that, you know, we all have different things. I love food and you love G-spot.
that's not go where I want to. But
I don't really have a category then.
I mean, I do other analogies as well, but I think what we're both doing in different ways is we're being memorable. Yeah. Because there's a reason why comedians, this is going to get like oddly deep for a second, there's a reason why comedians get attacked by dictators.
Yeah.
It's because when you make someone laugh, you disarm them and you open them up to receive information. Mm-hmm. And so if you simply said something very technically and just like, you need to put your hand over your knees. But as you're laughing, like, my G-spot's my knees, and you have a mental image of a 12-year-old looking up at mama, I know where, that entire story is stuck in your head. You will not forget this seminar. And So even if you need the anecdote of a silly of that silly situation, now it holds something. It's like a carrier. It's like a vector for the knowledge. And the same reason why I also like, I think humor is incredibly valuable to the learning process to many people. Just like there are how different people learn. So like I have to change how I teach things through traveling. That's one thing that the seminar teaching really helped me is like the way I taught a seminar in Israel or Taiwan where English is not the first language and many people, if I speak too quickly, will be lost. It will be very different than how I teach that very same seminar in Florida where almost everybody, English is the first language. I can speak very quickly or at least they're fluent in English. Even if English is the second language, like, yes, I know lots of people speak Spanish in Florida as well, but I don't get people in Florida being like, Charles, I need you to slow down. We can't understand you. Whereas when I was in countries where people are not universally fluent in English, I would have that situation where I got to speak slower or even cultural references, right? No one freaking eats tacos in Israel. I had to change it to a pita or a falafel. And so it became the falafel grip and the lafa grip because those are the foods that they ate there. And so like you, or even when I went to Germany, it's Döner kebab instead. It needs to be culturally relevant, especially because I'm not from most of the places that I teach. Even the fact that I know that street food in Germany is Döner kebab, it connects me to my students because like now I'm revisiting my first time there. Like, oh, like he appreciates our culture. And so like we've been talking about it a lot this trip, like our job and the job of a comedian is similar. Just instead of simply trying to make people laugh, we're trying to convey some knowledge that they keep with them. But the secondary thing that we have, the comedians don't, we also want these people to be able to move their bodies in a way. So it's not thinking differently is great, but they also need to move their body. And so relating things. Most people are not doctors. And so as much as I like learning the technical terminology, if I use the Latin name for things, I'm going to lose a lot of people unless I decide to make part of this class education, Latin, physiology terminology, which in a college town like Gainesville where I live, a lot of people might be interested in that. But if I go to other towns, they're like, hey, 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 it's a leg. Don't give me any of that fancy shit. Just call it a leg. That's enough for me. And so I think that that's understanding your audience and adjusting to it and being memorable. I think that's what we all have to be in common. For me, because I want to be invited back. For you, because you want your students not to leave the gym. It's just a different approach. You guys have the luxury of you're going to see these people tomorrow and the next day and the next day. So if you fuck up, you can be like, hey, guys, my bad. If I fuck up, that's what they remember of me. Is that the guy who fucked up?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Like, I think we get a lot of leeway in our students because I think, you know, Johnny Buck said it when he was on the podcast a few years ago, is that most people don't stick to their jiu-jitsu schools because of jiu-jitsu. They stick to it because it's where their friends are. And so sure. I think, you know, we got some leeway in how we can teach our jiu-jitsu. Like, as long as you've got the right atmosphere and everyone enjoys the place that they're at, we can, you know, hold our hands up and go, shit, like, you know, it's a growing sport and I'm just someone who's been playing this sport longer than you. Like, I'm still figuring this shit out. Like, but hear me out. I think this will work better.
I think that honesty is so important, though.
Yeah.
Because I think that especially, like, we both came from traditional martial arts.
We all did.
What was the traditional martial art you did first?
I got my black belt in traditional Japanese jiu-jitsu.
Even more so. Didn't you do Aikido as well, you said?
I've done bits of Aikido, bits of Wing Chun, Lao Ga.
I imagine in your Japanese jiu-jitsu, there wasn't a lot of questioning and differently?
You had a curriculum.
Yeah, you're just doing it off.
Kempo mixed with compliant judo.
And so I'll go back to that in a second because it is compliant judo. I remember I went to those classes, but like the desire and ability to question is almost seen as disrespectful in many of those spaces.
Yeah.
Right? So like I had situations both, and this even happens in jiu-jitsu as well with some of the guys where like if somebody does a move, like even me, like I did the move wrong. I couldn't get it. Raise my hand. Hey coach, like I'm not getting it. Rather than seeing it as an opportunity to correct me, for some of these guys, like it's a challenge. And so now they're going to try and like maim me as they demonstrate the move on me to prove its effectiveness when I'm just confused.
Yeah.
And so I think when you as the coach, Chris, say, hey guys, I'm experimenting with this, I don't know, I think it makes every other time that you say that you do know more impactful, because you're not pretending to be a god.
Yeah. I think I don't know, like having that humility is what makes it, makes you open-minded. If you're like, if you think you know it, the moment you think you know something, you just stop learning. You know, if you're like, I know it, you're not going to be receptive to a younger person or a less experienced person coming to you saying, hey, I was doing this, what do you think? You're going to be, no, I know it, that's wrong. But if you come at it like, I don't know, and you look at it, like, that's how I started approaching my teaching and the questions is like, if someone asks a question, I might know the answer, but I'm not going to like, I'm not going to spew it out. I'm going to be like, well, I don't know. We should look at it right now, because my jiu-jitsu has changed, my ideas have changed. So if I look at a new problem from I don't know, anything's possible.
Actually, I have a question for you about your background. So if you, was the Japanese jiu-jitsu at Fighting Fit or somewhere
else?
No.
I've put this, this has been on the podcast before.
I'm sorry, other podcast listeners.
No,
I'm serious.
This is fucking hilarious when you think about it. So I did Japanese jiu-jitsu, and some of the stuff like, these years later, I actually use now. I actually use Osotogari, Ogoshi, Uchimata, even some of the wrist locks and arm locks. I, in Keisa and stuff, I now use. But it was a lack of sparring that kind of made it so I didn't really understand how to use it properly. The only sparring we did was we'd start back to back, and it was the first person to get scarfold.
We did that too. I thought that my school was the only people who did that thing.
We didn't. There was no submissions. There was no guard. It was just first person to get scarfold. There was just tussle, scarfold. And then I got my black belt in that one in 2008, so I would have been 21. I then entered into a judo neiwaza competition where you'd enter in via your belt.
Oh, no.
And I, about 3 weeks before this competition, I'd heard of this legendary gym called Fighting Fit. And I thought, you know what, I'm a black belt, I'm going to go this place. I've done some of this ground fighting, and I'm going to go smoke these guys. They beat the shit out of me. I then went into this judo neiwaza competition with 3 lessons of actual combat experience, wearing a karate gi.
Oh, yeah.
And my first, like, I was there warming up with chain punches. And I went to my first fights. I think my first fight was against a BJJ blue belt. My second fight was against a judo black belt. And my third fight was against a BJJ purple belt.
That's rough.
And all I knew was scarfold, and I was wearing a karate gi. And like, they were slamming chokes on, and I thought, like, this is cheese wire. They're going to cut my head clean off.
Yeah. It's so funny that you had that experience. I wonder what that training methodology is, because I thought that my gym of karate guys doing ground fighting were the only people who did that training method of starting back to back and going for scarfold. Because that was our curriculum as well. That's how I ended up loving the headlock.
Yeah, yeah.
Because a headlock is pretty much almost scarfold. Yeah.
I think it's because... yeah, I mean, weirdly enough, back in those days, and I want to go into this conversation in a second, is that there was a huge spate in those days where even the competitions I go to, you'd start back to back. I think it's a judo thing.
That's how they do it in the military. Yeah. If you watch this, you'll see it in the military. You'll see that, and it's usually on like gravel, like some guys in boots starting back to back, and then they go.
I have no idea why the fuck that came from.
Yeah,
that.
So many of us.
You did as well.
So many of us would headbutt when that happened. Whap!
So. You know, it's funny, like, you remind me of this story. I was, before we got homeported, when I was on that ship, it was stationed in California before I went to Hawaii.
Yeah.
And I went to this Kempo karate school, and, like, I already done Kempo karate, you know, so I'm like, all right, we'll find a little home. It was a Parker lineage as well. And I went in there, and, you know, because I trained in the garage with a guy who was, you know, let us kind of get rowdy, I already had, like, I would kind of hit a little too hard in the body, I guess, because that's what I was used to. Mm-hmm. I went to the school. They did not like my lack of control, they said. And I said, well, that's control because, like, you should see my instructor. It's relative, right? I'm like, this is great control. And then there was one day I came on, and they were doing all ground stuff. And all I did was sleep for the scarf all over my head. That's how I won most of it. I was like, and it was a Kimbo school that was doing it, but I was like, I got this. I got this. And then, you know, I ran, when I ran to real jiu-jitsu, got my ass whooped real quick. And I was like, we're good. We're
but
gonna,
isn't
we're going to learn this. We're going to learn this.
Crazy thing. That all three of us, independently, like Florida, California, UK, were taught the same kind of like, it was not nothing. Because it was enough that we all were winning in our small little fish pools.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we had this inflated idea of our own abilities and then realized, oh shit, we're wrong. But I think it's fascinating that like with just a Keza Katami and an understanding of holding tight, how effective we were on people who knew nothing.
Yeah,
that really is a testament to like the value of knowing anything versus being a complete civilian.
So I will say that even now, the head and arm control, Keza, against a guy who was really good at it, like a judo guy or someone that that's their specialty, it's fucking hard.
Oh, yeah.
I've had to tap in that thing because it just gets so uncomfortable.
Oh.
And it's like oh, the look, nothing against, like, you know, my lineage, but none of that shit that, and it's on the record now. I call it shit because I could not make it work when I needed to against someone that I know more technique, and I've been doing it longer, and I can get held down by that move, and I can't get fucking out if they hold my elbow.
Yeah.
You know,
but I think that's partially because of the fact that, like,
I'm going back to that.
I've been using it because I did judo, and judo respects it, jiu-jitsu doesn't, and I was always like scolded at the jiu-jitsu gym
for playing
regular Keza rather than underhook Keza. And it works. But jiu-jitsu has such a history of blind spots for, no, we know better, don't question it. And I think that the cool thing about now is because there's so many more competitions. If you just think about back then, like you said you had competed, but how often was there a competition?
Yeah.
Right? Probably very infrequently. And so if you wanted to compete, it was every few months at the best, if you were lucky.
Yeah.
Whereas now, in Florida, every weekend, there are multiple tournaments.
Yeah.
Virtually every weekend of the year, if you want to compete. And it's some sort of grappling. And so you get to see that wider thing, whereas it wasn't uncommon, if you lived in a smaller town, that the only jiu-jitsu you ever saw were your teammates.
Yeah.
And so now you're stuck in those blinders.
Well, and Josh Barnett, when they were doing the Metamoros, he got hit on with that, and he couldn't get out of it.
Yeah,
that move is legit. And you know, when we're talking here, when I teach, anytime I'm going from here to here or here to here, X mark to smart, I just call it looping, creating loops.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, like if we get the good Keza, we've created a loop.
Yeah.
But if you go back to what Chris says, right? Like it's exactly what you say. You're peeling out. And you're in that space that we care about, and you're attaching to a head. Like it's fundamentally sound, like in theory.
It's painful. It turns to something that can joke you, put you out.
Like peeling the elbow
and
open is what I'm
talking about.
It
stops your rotation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did you get when we were in Memphis?
Yeah.
When was it, Mark? Did Mark put you in his caser?
No, he did not.
Oh, I asked for that.
Yeah.
There was a guy.
Oh no, he did. He did. Yes.
Big old boy,
the wrestler guy.
Yeah, in his 50s, Olympic alternate, used to train with the Schultz brothers.
Oh shit! Say no more.
Yeah,
we're good.
Exactly, and
miserable.
He was showing us some ideas, and he showed. He said, you know, he's got a good case, and I was like, I need to feel this, and he put me on it. I was like, Jesus fucking Christ! Like this feels like it's gonna blow my chest out.
I've been put in two like that. One was a big 240-pound judo black belt from Europe. I forget his name. He came in, and I couldn't move. The other one, Ian Heinisch, like he did an instructional for jiu-jitsu on the go where he did his head and arm. He can catch this thing really. I roll with him a little bit, you know, because he was coming back and you know I was gonna be his coach. But we played in Florida or either Florida or wherever PFL. Chris was there. We went out there. We were in his corner. I think it was Florida. We went to the PFL in Florida for Camozzi. And we started training. I already knew he was good at this move. And when he started passing, as soon as he got to that, I knew he was going for it. I just shrink the elbow. and I'm telling you, it was like really close. If he would have caught that bitch, I'm going out. Because he came here to come and, you know, train.
Yeah.
While he comes here to do his camps when he was fighting. And we were training here. We get in the position. I was like, hold me in the position. Spent tons of time in the position. And, like, no avail. Nothing. Yeah. Nothing worked. Kamosi, he's like, all I do is he will take his thumb and you push on that shoulder and try to Heisman up a little bit to take the pressure off. Mm-hmm. And then, like, rock him and try to wiggle out. Yeah. But, man, I tell you, that hurt.
but to go
I didn't want to do it anymore. Fuck that.
To go back to what we were saying about that idea of being mortal to your students,
yeah.
I think that we're kind of diverging, right? Because all three of us care about why a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
And we obsess about why. Mm-hmm. Well, because why is what makes you a great coach. And you said it yourself earlier, when you understand why, you have the power to self-improve. I've heard you use the phrase self-healing jiu-jitsu in the past, right?
That's good.
And that's what it is. However, it's not for everyone. I've met people who have no interest in why at all. Mm-hmm. They just want to beat people up and win. No, coach, I don't, just tell me what to do and I'll do it. And you'll meet some of those guys who they have no idea why what they're doing is works, but they're emulating someone very effective, whether they're trying to be a clone of a Mendez brother or a Gary Tonin or Gordon Ryan. But if you have a similar body type and you emulate someone whose body type matches yours and you just blindly follow them, you will have a large amount of success. Now, mind you, you will have a ceiling. You will never be able to be better than that which you are copying if you are blindly copying.
Yeah.
But if that which you are copying is presumably top 10, top 5 in the world, and you're trying to compete at a local blue belt tournament, that's going to be enough. Yeah. You know, it's going to be more than enough. Whereas on the other end, when you obsess about why, well, when you get put in that new weird submission, you can now problem solve your way out of it live on the fly. A person who doesn't understand why cannot. All they really have is, well, maybe I should just do something harder, faster, stronger. Yeah. That's all they have because they don't have why. They have their steps. I do step 1, 2, 3, 4. And that's going to be powerful for them if the 1, 2, 3, 4 they've been taught is a good 1, 2, 3, 4,
yeah.
Which in a way is, I think, what the Gracie system is. It's an effective set of moves that, if done in sequence, is relatively easy to acquire and learn. Because think about what, you know, there's the steps to jiu-jitsu, right? Like,
yeah.
Get the match to the floor, get past the legs, get to a position, get to a better position, ultimately being on the back, being the best position. Like, that it's a good set of steps. And even more specifically, right, if you had, like, in the Meow days, like, if you were just a Barambola player, that was enough to win most tournaments in that era.
Yeah.
And so I think it's kind of an interesting thing where, like, I have a hard time with those types of students because, like, I don't want to train. I call it the division between, if I'm Dr. Frankenstein, I can either make a monster or I can train fellow scientists.
Yeah.
I always find it so much more rewarding to train up fellow scientists because I can learn from them.
Yeah, collaboration, right?
Whereas if I'm just making you into a monster, like, you can be dangerous. And many of the people that, like, I've helped make into monsters are deathly powerful and dangerous. And other people, they don't necessarily have the understanding of jiu-jitsu that some of the guys over here do, but they can beat them up because they're better athletes, they're meaner, they have less, like, they have the things that takes to be a fighter,
mm-hmm.
but they're not the greatest teachers. And understanding that, like, the hard thing for me was realizing, like, not everyone wants to take the path that I'm taking, and I have to be respectful of that and give them what they're here for. So this guy wants to be a fighter, this one wants to lose weight, this one wants to understand things like I do because they have that similar mindset.
I think that's one thing, is, like, especially because we're both academy owners, is that, you know, the whole idea of humility and being able to admit that you're wrong. It does get weighed up, though, because, like, you know, going, like, splitting between the two of you right now, because I kind of sit on the fence with these things, is, you know, when you're doing a seminar, like I say, you have to give that condensed, you know, thing that, you know, if I want to do really well right now because I want to be invited back, you know, this is how I make my money. But at the same time, when you're an academy owner, like, you have to be humble, you have to be able to admit, you know, humility. But at the same time, you're taking people's money, and they're paying for a service. And it's when you're academy owner, you think, right, shit, like, if I do this wrong, if I show weakness, if I show that I fucked up, that I didn't know what I was doing, are they going to leave? And then that's then the problem, is you think, shit, like, it's being able to balance, like, you know, being able to say, like, shit, I did this, I know better now. And, you know, when I think, you know, it's easy for them, some coaches, like I say, to become hyper-aggressive or making an unquestionable environment, because it's almost like it's the fragility of that, the business that they're running.
Established dominance.
Yeah.
You know, I've experienced a lot with this, and what I always do is I treat all my classes as an open conversation. That we're here, and I've been on the path longer than you, and I might have some good ideas, but yeah. I want to know what you're thinking, because your mind sees something too that maybe I'm missing. It's going to add value to the class. It's going to add value to me, and it allows me to make mistakes.
Yeah.
Because we're just exploring something.
Yeah.
And you know what? Like one of the guys who, I will say this, you know, coming up under Helson was a very harsh kind of instructor, which I appreciated because it was military. So I didn't mind. You could tell me I'm fucking up and you could say, that's wrong. You know, like I'm going to be like, okay, show me how to do it right then. You know, like I don't care. You know, like just show me what I need to know if I'm doing it wrong. Whereas when I started working with Kaiki, he took the praise, correct praise, and he put it into an adult context. Like he would, like if I would come to him with an idea that he didn't agree with, he would not ever tell me that.
Yeah.
He would say, let me see it. And he would allow me to do it with very mild resistance. And he would say, I was like, oh, that's pretty good. All right, let's try again. And then he would change something and it would stop me. And then he would say, now I'm receptive to learning.
Yeah.
And he would teach me. I think if you do this and that, I like your idea, but maybe add this. And then you would do it that way. And he'd say, very good. And, you know, like, I never felt disempowered when he would correct me. I never felt disempowered. Whenever he would call, I never have any anxiety, like I did something wrong. With Helson, it was different.
Yeah,
so that praise, correct, praise, which works really great for kids, also works for adults. But how do you context it? How do you make it to where it's like, it works for adults? Kaiki had the perfect method, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I learned a lot from just being around a master like that knows people, knows how to, you know, inspire, motivate, and he knows the right things to say. He knows when and he checks on you, like checks on me all the time, you know, like it's one of those guys, you know.
Yeah.
But his method really showed me how to be a better teacher, you know.
I think, especially because I'm not saying I'm anywhere near the level of militaristic that you are, you know, because I came from the fire, but it's still got its elements, is that, you know, I remember going through basic and you know, it was the same idea. Like, you know, you stood to the shun and you got a round of fucks all day long.
Yep.
And there is benefit to that, you know, as cruel as it is at the time.
Mental toughness.
Yeah, it builds your resilience to stress.
Grit.
Which, we're in a fucking combat sport. and that's, again, like.
Yeah, every day, and it's like we live in it like it's fun, and like some people are terrified to come to the academy.
Exactly, you know? Yeah, and that's the thing, is creating the right messaging for the right people. I think some, you know, you are in a combat sport, so as mad as it sounds, you have to almost give them a round of fucks. And I said in the car earlier, like, you know, one of my first bosses in the fire, you know, he used to say that, you know, if I say you're fucking stupid, it's not personal. Like, you've just done some stupid shit, but, you know, it's not personal. You're not a stupid person, you've just done stupid shit. And so it was kind of like, it's been able to create that, you know, disconnect. Even my wrestling coach used to say, outside I'll be your best friend, but in here I'm going to give you an absolute fucking horrible time. But that built that toughness. And yeah, it's like, again, it's like finding that balance, you know, what creates the right messaging for the right people. Do you give people a round of fucks and like give them a horrible time because they'll become tougher for it, or do you assist them?
Well, I like what you said about, like, creating an experience of humor. I always have something to make my students always laugh when I teach class. And it's either I have my antagonist in the class, which is like Mark.
Yeah.
And like he will purposely like do things because, you know, we bust each other's chops a little bit. We have fun.
Yeah.
We don't go too crazy, but sometimes it gets a little high handed. Maybe people can't really, they don't get that humor. But I would say for the most part, they're like creating that experience, like you said, being kind of like an act, you know, to convey the information. That laughter is real important, man. I agree with that 100%.
Just got to be memorable. I mean, you can't be like, and I used to teach kids. So this is like the praise with the kids. Teaching 4-year-olds
Oh, yeah.
Is some of the most tiring work. Like, I would rather teach a room of 100 adults than teach a room of 10 4-year-olds. Like, tough. Teaching the 100 adults, significantly easier. Because you have to, like, pitch a no-hitter against 4-year-olds. You must, for the entire, and those classes usually are only a half an hour long, but for those 30 minutes, you must be the most interesting thing on earth.
And fun.
And you must be fun, and you must be entertaining, and you must be happy.
And goofy.
If you are,
yeah. God.
If there is a piece of glitter on the floor, or a toy, or a ball, and that ball is more interesting than you, you've lost one. And once you've lost one, all the rest are like, what's he doing? And now you're screwed. So teaching kids, I actually took a lot of the games that I now do with the adults from games with kids. It actually goes back to your original question of like how I look at these things. A lot of the games that I started playing that I guess I don't believe they would qualify as the ecological approach, though they are task-based games, they do have goals. Mm-hmm. I was like, how can I trick people who don't know anything of jiu-jitsu? Because I still am regularly teaching at karate and kempo gyms and places where no one does jiu-jitsu.
Oh, wow.
And you think that teaching white belts is one thing. No. Teaching no belts, it's an entire room of people. Imagine having an entire room of intro people, which I imagine when you started your gym you had. But you've had at least one or two seasoned people around for quite some time now in your gyms, both of you. I have to trick them. And so I have to construct a game that is not at all martial, that is just like a game of tag or something, but I make the rules such that I trick them into doing jiu-jitsu. And in the course of a half an hour, like, you'll have 5-year-olds who look like they're doing a guard passing game, which is what I had them doing, but as far as they know, they're just trying to touch somebody's hair. Or like, same thing happened when I was teaching in Mallorca. I substitute taught, so you know Yogi Jack, and he used to teach in Mallorca. I was a substitute teacher for him in Mallorca. And there was a guy who brought his daughter in. His daughter was like 7, and she was taking the Do class. So whoever was the odd person out in the role, I wasn't gonna have adults roll with her, they had to play open guard with no hands, and it had a 7-year-old try to touch their hair. 7-year-olds don't really get tired.
No.
So you're effectively doing an ab workout for the whole time. And so like, I love all of that stuff, and it's the constant evolution and changing. But I personally think when it comes to the showing weakness, that you will lose people when you show them that God bleeds, right? When you show them that you don't have every answer and you're not God. Mm-hmm. But the people that you lose, they are the same people who want the cultishness of jiu-jitsu that I don't think any of us really want. There are some guys who lead into the whole idea of being treated as a deity in their gym. Yeah. And at least, like, we'll make jokes, but I don't think any of us actually want that. And if someone really wants that and you tell them that you're fallible and that makes them leave, your school's probably better for it.
Yeah. One question before we start wrapping up, because amazing, this has already been going for an hour, pretty much.
Oh.
You mentioned just before we started recording, you got Fanatics happening.
Yeah, I did the arm entanglement with them, and then that sells, you know, when they put it out for the daily deal. So I reached out to him. I was like, hey, I've been doing a lot of MMA work. I think you guys would like this. So I was going to do the bladed guard for him. And
yeah, that,
that was so good. Like, I have to, it's taking the stuff that we've all done, but like, I've never done that. And like, I'm going to steal the shit out of it and use it now. But like, it's brilliant. I love it.
So Bladed Guard by Steve Ordinsky, that is going to be created for, we've just been playing with that in the gym, and even I'm like, you know, hopefully now, even though I'm going to put him on the spot with this, going to get a little snippet for the YouTube, just of this bladed guard, because I ended up on my ass more than I expected, and it blends in so many things we've been doing together.
Yeah, it's like right next door to like all of my stuff that I was testing over.
Right next door to my stuff. I'm like, oh my God, it is a good job we came back to Denver.
Well, it was inspired by both of you guys.
Yeah, and to see where you've taken it, I am so.
And it's right with what I was talking about with the whole idea of like, we've taught our stuff all over the world, both of us.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone has taken it and like, because there's one thing just to ape it and be like, oh, I will put my elbow here now, or I will play Running Man like Chris does, or I will understand, but you've taken it and you've put your own seasoning on the thing, and now it's, I don't do that. So I can't say that you got it for me, because I don't do that. Like, I do pieces of that, but that what you made is something, is your own contribution. You've taken and added your own stuff. I think it's great, man.
So as the final bit we're going to finish up on then is, hopefully Steve is just going to give us a quick, I don't, you know, because he's gonna give us a full Fanatics like one day, which, you know, buy that shit. But yeah, we'll get a snippet now of Bladed Guard and how.
And if the Fanatics don't want it, I'm gonna do it with you guys.
Yeah,
it's all that matter.
As you can see here, I've got some decent kit for recording. Like, so we're good.
Yeah, you got.
Yeah,
good
so.
Stuff.
Just give me a second. I'm just going to make sure I can see what the hell I'm doing. Yeah, Steve.
Keep the mic on, too?
Yeah, keep the mic on. And we'll just make sure it doesn't rub too much.
So, like, I got the idea from Charles's, you know, placement with the foot. And the MMA guy smashed me. And I love it. So, I was doing all this, and then I get broken down.
This mic. Can I wait to frame on that mic?
Yeah, it's fine.
I'm talking this time anyway. Yeah, so I have this one, and then I know I'm, sometimes I just take it and I'm here, break it down, and I stick this foot in too, and I like kind of separate them. So like I'm pushing this way and pulling back with the other one, and I just track in the inside space, and I manage the hand, and I go here, and it's like just this frontal assault is so hard to get through that like sometimes the guys will try to get past the knee, and once they get to the here, I just rock them. And I can attack, or I can reset it.
So I just looked at that from a different angle. So because I couldn't see there. So
yeah. So like right here, even though like everybody's like, "Are you worried about them smashing your knee?" No, because I can just stand up. You know, if they take the pressure off me. So if they're in the pressure funnel here, which is what I call it, I'm like, "All right, I'm good." And then they like really get like frustrated. And like, "I'm gonna get past this knee." Boom here, and I just move just a little bit, open a little bit. Sometimes you sweep and you can enter the legs, or the good guys catch themselves. And I just reset, so.
So you've got that bottom leg trapping.
Yeah, so this one's right
back
here.
Back leg, yeah.
This one's right here, just trapped, like hooked in.
So you've got hooks.
So I have my primary hook, my shallow hook, primary hook, shallow hook, shallow hook, primary hook. And then, here.
So almost like a sideways butterfly kind of position you've got with your bottom leg hooked over the far calf. Yeah.
And then what I like is like, when they step over, it's like they think they're getting to mount. So even though they get here, stepping over, and I'm pinched here now, and I just open
back
a little bit,
yeah.
And then look, boom, reset. Even if they don't backstep, if they backstep, I usually follow. They backstep here, I just follow, and then
straight
into scoop
saddle.
Into the saddle.
Yeah,
and that's been like really fun, and you know, there's different plays with it. You can play here, you can play here, you can play here, you can play here with it, but this. This is like primary where I
this
like
is like spin. The direct follow to unstoppable stand-ups.
Yeah.
Like this is amazing.
Well,
and
where I found myself too is like I'll be up here and let's say the guy is just back kicks real fast. And I'm like up, you know, like, you know, he's trying to smash me, but back step, I'm like, I'm out, you know. So I just stand up, and it works with the gi too because I'll grab here, just like here, you know, and then come up, reset, back in.
It's the perfect blend of everything.
Well, it all goes together.
It's like, to me, it fits in really well because I got so obsessed with stepping on that calf, but I was able to switch positions real fast.
Yeah.
But like for me, because I'm always trying to defend the leg lock, I always kind of kept my foot on the other side. So I always came here.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, I never did that. Like, maybe what you're talking about with the sidedness, like my left leg, I don't play it very often. But when you fold to your side, I'm like, oh, this is like a scissor sweep.
Yeah.
And it's like I'm doing a scissor sweep between your legs, like a scissor butterfly baby. Mm-hmm. And like, this feels really freaking cool.
And the leg attacks too, man. If you knock them off balance, all that stuff is like and right then there, John Wayne's.
All my other stuff that I like, because I still see that.
Yeah.
I can always just get up
boop.
And play the game that I'm currently
off
playing.
The limit and,
and then, so like it really ties it all together.
And I like it too, like right in this position here, I would just
switch
boom,
sides
I'd
right
go back
into,
too
it.
Into it. You know, like that way, like I'm always, I have like a way to get to it from both sides, you know?
That's so perfect. We're just out of time. This is about to die, this recording.
This was dope. Thanks, man.
This is amazing. Yeah, please check out Steve Wodinski. Please check out Charles Harriet. Links in the YouTube video. Thank you guys for your time.
Awesome.
But yeah, check out their recordings.
Yeah.